Hi there, this is Ed McGuire, Insights Partner with Momenta Partners. Welcome to the Momenta Intelligent Edge podcast series, where we feature leading practitioners and thinkers across connected industry and the broader technology landscape. And welcome everyone to our Momenta Edge podcast. Our guest today is the CEO and founder of Augmate, Pete Wassel. Pete, it's great to have you on.
Ed, hey, thank you so much for inviting me. Love everything that you're doing at Momenta. It's been great to connect at some of the meetups and conferences, you know, recently in the IoT space. So very excited to be here today.
Well, we've been a huge fan of you and the team at Augmate, and this is a great opportunity for us to really help some of our listeners understand a bit more context and your background, and we'll get a chance to dive into some of your views on the industry as well.
Super. Okay, perfect.
Yeah, so first off, Pete, it'd be great to hear a bit of your background. I mean, what got you into technology and what, you know, what are the steps that ultimately led you to found Augmate and bring you to where we are today?
Sure. Yeah, so my background is I went to engineering school. I went to Clarkson University in upstate New York. And, that really kind of set the foundation for, thinking about technology and computers and just, you know, over the time from when I had started, you know, in school, I got picked up by IBM in my senior year of college. And I spent also a number of years in Silicon Valley. And I think between both IBM from, let's say, a scalability standpoint and just their, you know, sheer size and footprint, to then being in Silicon Valley and seeing startups and really how they operate, really formed my thoughts about the company and technology. How technology is used to solve problems in the marketplace and can become kind of an engine for capital. And those things ultimately led me to Augmate. And, I guess I'd have to say that, I've taken the advice of mentors and folks along the way. You know, they say follow your passion. So when the right technology came along, I felt that, I had the experience and the insights and, enough sense and enough naivety as well to start the company.
It's super interesting that what you're involved with at Augmate really touches on several, I think, really profound and really consequential technology trends. One is wearables, the other is virtual reality or augmented reality, and the other is blockchain. But I'd like to address each one and drill down a little bit into some of the dynamics around wearables and just talk first about what you saw in the market when you were first looking at Augmate and how you looked at wearables early on, because I think as we look back to, boy, the kind of late 80s or early 90s, you'd have these headsets that were very, very bulky and couldn't really work. And of course, digital, many of us had a Casio watch in our geeky younger days, but really wearable tech has only in the last decade become a category that where we you would have these really single purpose devices, and I'd be love to understand your perspective and your experience as you looked at the market evolve and what you saw in the market that led you to identify some burning pain points out there.
Yeah. We've got a ton of technology, right, at Augmate, and disciplined approach to engineering and building product and everything. But in reality, often the things that inspire you and motivate you in the beginning, kind of come from fantasy and early on sci-fi pictures, whether it was Terminator, thinking about Terminator Vision, that was kind of one of the first thoughts I had about augmented reality. leaping further to, Iron Man kind of thinking, that's where it starts. Unfortunately, those concepts, they're great. And there's whole businesses, sci-fi ventures actually will come in and help you write a business plan that has to do with future technology, right? Uh-huh. But, the reality is those concepts, while designed by artists and, CGI and special effects and whatnot, they leave a lot out, right? There's a lot of technology underneath that has to be built in order to make that stuff a reality. And it's great that it, plants the seed and it inspires folks. But then, then the real work comes into building it. And oftentimes there's a convergence of technology that has to take place. So in other words, you might have one piece of it or two pieces of it, but, a third, let's say an unknown piece, and it's only until that piece hits the market that you're able to combine it all and make some of these things a reality. The way I had started was I took a disciplined approach. I started building out slides on kind of the history of wearables. And I'll send this over to you. It's kind of amusing. But, ended up being over, 50, probably 60 slides. And each slide was kind of a, incremental part of the technology. Right. And so I put, a little blurb on it, maybe a picture if it was a device or, some sort of technology. And what I was trying to do was you look in the past, right, and you kind of start making these points to figure out the future, right, the trajectory of where things are going. So that was kind of it was like a scientific approach to doing it. What it's good for is pointing the direction to technology. So oftentimes they'll say, you'll know the direction of technology, but you may not know the timing. So market timing from an adoption standpoint and that kind of thing, that's the part that's tricky. It's a little bit easier to figure out where things are going, but it's kind of the when that's the challenge. Early on when it came to wearables, I'd have to say, those early movies and those types of things got me thinking about, really the end goal, which was kind of a brain to computer interface, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I started thinking about it, I thought to myself, what's the biggest bandwidth to the brain, right? What pipe is the biggest bandwidth? And it turns out to be, your vision. And so your optic nerve, you already have a wire to your brain. It's your optic nerve, right? And so by placing a computer on your face, in having smart glasses is this way to facilitate it. It's not perfect. You're not plugging into the brain, but it's a way to get closer. And I thought that was, incremental enough of a technology and, that made sense to start moving onto that kind of platform.
It's really interesting because the evolution of augmented reality or wearables, a lot of there was a lot of basis for, flight or pilot flight simulators, but also smart goggles for airline pilots. But I don't know if you must have been familiar with Steve Mann from MIT, the guy who had really equipped himself with a constant recording device. I mean, it was pretty geeky, but it was pretty amazing. A lot of that vision back then. Were there any use cases that struck you as particularly promising or viable at that point, or some that just seemed a bit too much of a mismatch between where the where technology was, say, a decade ago or when you first started looking at it and the vision?
So Steve Mann is a friend of mine. We've actually worked on a law together for wearables. And when he got started at MIT, he actually wore the smart glass device that he invented. And later on, the interviewer had commented and said, this kid is either crazy or a genius. And, obviously he's more on the genius side. So Steve was definitely an influence. And fortunately, he would give me time early on to kind of pick his brain and talk to him about, how things are going. Another guy early on here in the city was Stephen Feiner from Columbia University. And so Stephen, if you look at any of the academic research that's out there, papers that were written, it's Steve working with some of the earliest smart glasses. And I'm talking like 1996, 97, all the way through, you know, early 2000s kind of devices. And he's still, you know, he still does it today. And Steve Feiner and I got to be friends. He attends our augmented reality meetup each month. It's Arnie, Augmented Reality New York. And he's become a friend and, you know, oops. Apologize for for that. That's my phone.
that's an audio signal. We get that.
Steve Feiner was great. And I, you know, again, I would pick his brain. He would do things like, maintenance on, let's say, a printer or an automobile, figuring out kind of instructional workflow with smart glasses. So, 20 years ago. And I would pick his brain and he'd give me time and sit down and talk. Ori Inbar, who actually started Augmented Reality in New York, he was an influence, and early meetups had inspired me to, get together with like-minded individuals, right? And you start talking and thinking about how you can make certain things work. A woman, Christine Perry, she started a group called AR Standards many years ago, and I was a participant in that group, and then she later started Area, which is Augmented Reality for Enterprise Alliance. And some of these things, they're tough to do on your own. So when you get together in groups that have a similar passion, it just makes it a little bit easier. It gives you the confidence and support network in order to implement these things.
That's really interesting that you were able to collaborate with all of these, really cutting edge thinkers at the time. What did you learn about, this concept of collaboration and, consortiums, with technology that was, at the time, some of the enterprise wearable technology was quite cutting edge. And this, you made this really key point, I think, which is this idea of collaborating. Are there some lessons that have stayed with you in that experience?
Well, I think that it's one of those things. Emerging technologies are such that nobody's got all the answers. So people are trying to figure out, it's almost the premise of a startup. A startup is trying to figure out the business model and technology model, right, and take it to market. And people who know me and know my background with corporate in IBM, to be able to go back and forth and kind of see the problems with a big company when it comes to things like process, bureaucracy, red tape, and those types of things, to the way you think in a startup and being really agile and kind of navigating the space and, knowing that 90% of what you try is going to fail, right? And you have to iterate, and it's not win or lose or win or fail. It's really win or learn. And you have to just get right back out there. And it's having that persistence and resiliency in order to do that. You have to work with a group of people. So, I'm a big fan of the meetups and conferences and listening to others talk to kind of collect information and then, go about it as a team. It's I've learned, I might be the founder of the company, but I heavily rely on my team members for so much that kind of take care of me and get things done. And advisors as well, and so listening to their guidance and advice, and when questions come up and decisions have to be made, really looking to, get some other opinions in order to make really good decisions.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great insight. And what's so interesting too about wearables is that, the market itself really took off or gained a lot of, how should we say, public attention when you had the Fitbit IPO and people were buying Jawbone fitness trackers and of course the Apple Watch came out. But how would you really compare and contrast the evolution of what you saw on the consumer side with the with the enterprise side on wearables?
It's really, I think it's totally fascinating. So, they're just different use cases. And I'll even preface this by saying, we're not even all the way there yet. So Augmented had started as a Glass at Work partner, with Google. And that particular device, they were marketing and positioning as a consumer device. I didn't think it was ready, and I was vocal and adamant about telling them that. I thought it was enterprise. There were other smart glass companies that said similar things. When I said I was going after industry, they said, hey, this is really an entertainment and gaming and that kind of consumer device. And the technology really wasn't there yet, and I just didn't think it was the right move. And later on, they came back and said, "Yeah, you were right about it." And it's only this year, right? So 4 years later, that we're starting to see smart glasses hit the market that are really discreet. And when you think about the consumer backlash on the consumer side, there's a camera on these things, right? So, people were nervous and that, scared them. And frankly, if the devices that are coming out this year that are really discreet, in fact, you can't tell that they're smart glasses, that someone's wearing smart glasses, I wonder if that would have even had a worse backlash at that time. Because, then at that point, there's no way of telling, that someone's got, a computer, literally, in their field of view. But, ultimately the technology, it's one of those things that it will gain adoption, and it can gain adoption in a number of different ways, but the premises add up and the premises make sense. And that's, information in your field of view. And what we believe here at Augmate is that, digital information is not where it's needed or expected. Right. And so, I want to be able to essentially right click on the world to get more information about it. And I can't do that. I'm trapped in a physical world, but yet I need digital information. And the phone's not good enough. I want to have it, literally, attached to physical world objects. When, especially in a worker setting. Okay. So the folks that we work with, the target audience or users of our technology, they're kind of the mobile workforce. They're deskless workers, right? So if you're in an office, you typically don't use this kind of technology. These are people, on the factory floor, field workers, supply chain in a warehouse, the construction site, these other places who traditionally didn't have access to this kind of technology, but would certainly benefit from it. And this information in your field of view, it's such that you want to keep your workers in a state of flow. Right. So if you have to reference a paper-based manual, laptop, or some other system, and then they come back to the task at hand, oftentimes they can make mistakes. And besides that, you need access to hands-free information. When you go from a mobile device, and someone can make the argument, you could have an app on a smartphone. When you go from a mobile device to smart glasses, you double the amount of hands that you have to work with. And oftentimes these are people who need their hands to do their job.
Wow. Can you talk about how you approach the management problem for glasses? I mean, you just mentioned that you're doubling the number of devices that an employee may have. I mean, how did you approach the pain points or the business problems of some of the types of customers that you're working with, and what have you learned so far about the needs of businesses that are trying to harness this technology and really take advantage of the vision that you just articulated?
So early on, we were doing the end user applications on smart glasses. So we were doing, the pick and pack application or the workflow application or, telepresence, see what I see, kind of applications. And we would do phenomenal pilots. You're brought into an 8 to 10 week pilot. You get baseline metrics on the first day. At the end of the project, they want to, see how well you've done. And, we would always do a great job. So we would, we could improve work by saving a worker, let's say 30 minutes a day. We improve accuracy or efficiency rates by, 8% or 9%. So these would all be really great. And when you're figuring out the business case or ROI, that's the kind of metrics you need to apply to a workforce in order to figure out, is this a project that we want to implement? And that would all work out fine. The piece would be when you went over to the IT department and you wanted to roll out the technology, these IT administrators would say, hey, we're good at rolling out tablets, but, not so good on the wearable side. Like, in other words, they didn't really have the tools or processes to deploy fleets of wearables. They needed the ability to remote wipe a device or reset someone's password or install applications. All the typical things you do with, you know, some other piece of hardware, that just wasn't available. And so we built out the product in order to focus on that device management, user management, policy, security, over-the-air updates, kind of features that were needed, you know, at the time. And really, you know, that's become the basis of expanding into IoT. So we wanted to get wearables down really well. So we've, you know, we had 25 security features built into our wearables platform, great functionality. Essentially, when we put our provisioning software on those devices, you can operate them from the web. You could actually operate those devices from the web. And so doing something small very, very well puts you in the right kind of position in order to expand. So that's become the foundation and the basis of why and how Augmate is now expanding into all of IoT. We believe wearables are a subset of IoT.
Yeah, and that's a great lead-in too, which I was really going to wanted to dive in a bit deeper, because this idea that a wearable device or a headset essentially is just another, you know, another endpoint or another device, and of course we'll start to see the number and complexity proliferate. Can you talk about your vision for how this how this platform that you've built, you know, how will this extend from, you know, the special, you've worked with specialized devices and you've had to work with different manufacturers, and is it possible to have a maybe a universal, you know, control platform, and or, you know, how much work do you have to do individually with different types of manufacturers and different types of form factors to, you know, to be able to have a common baseline of management capability?
Yeah. First of all, some of the things that kind of shaped, you know, my way of thinking on IoT was really, you know, the fact that, you know, the cost of sensors has gone down tremendously. So, you know, you we're getting to thinking about the point in time of when technology makes sense, right, to really start jumping on board and making things happen. The cost of storage has gone down tremendously. The rise in artificial intelligence. So when I talk about converging technologies that are needed, these are some of those fundamental pieces that underpin what's needed. You know, 5G, right, is coming like right around the corner. So these kinds of things all come together that, you know, then you're able to start moving, you know, in that proper direction. You know, when it comes to the devices or a, you know, universal management system on this stuff, there's a couple thoughts on that. So, you know, number one, you know, we're going from, you know, 10 or 12 devices to thousands of devices, right? And that's a real challenge. So there has to be some ways to be able to tackle that effectively. So one, you can narrow things down by industry and by use case. You know, you could focus in on pain points that make the most sense to solve those problems in the marketplace. And, you know, that can kind of narrow your field. But one of the biggest things that's really influenced us as far as a new technology is really blockchain. And so it's the emergence of blockchain. And this is something that we're, you know, doing very uniquely, you know, within Augmate in our IoT platform, that we think distinguishes ourselves and makes us not only unique, but it's totally appropriate for IoT. I'd say IoT and blockchain is a marriage made in heaven. And I'd be happy to talk about, you know, the details of why that's the case. But essentially, you know, we don't have to have software on every device. So, you know, we believe that in the next 3 to 4 years, you won't be able to buy a piece of equipment, a device, an appliance, any of these things that are not connected to the internet. So that's not going to be an option. So you could just imagine, you know, one of the guys that's influenced me a lot was Dave Evans. He was a CTO of Cisco. And I've talked with Dave, you know, quite a bit. About his, he did Cisco's IoT strategy, essentially, a brilliant guy. And, you know, we've talked about this, and just the sheer volume of devices that are coming out. You know, we're talking, 40 to 50 billion by 2020, quarter trillion by 2025 and about a trillion devices over the next 20 years. So it's huge. And we characterize this as the fourth generation of the internet. So this is really a distributed kind of intelligence. When you have these connected devices, we're building for the applications and services that ride on top of that infrastructure layer. So just as you know, think back to 2006 and, you know, the kind of phones we had, it was hard to imagine that your life would depend on these smartphones, that you'd be glued to them, that they'd change your life. Well, that's how people are going to feel about the fourth generation. So when that generation of the internet really emerges, and that's what we're building towards, those applications and services are going to help humanity in such a way that it's hard to fathom right now the impact it's going to have on society.
Now that's it is really just a level of scale and orders of magnitude that is really hard to imagine. You made a comment about blockchain, and I wanted to follow up on that, which is, you know, really why blockchain is so useful for IoT. I'd love to hear your thoughts about, you know, why is it important? Why is it so suitable? And then why did you find the technology, you know, to fit so well with what you're doing at Augmate?
Well, you know, when I started thinking about the devices, you know, that we were going to add, you know, one of our chief engineer, he had sent me a list of Android devices because we were primarily an Android shop at the time. There was, I don't know what the number was, 250, 400 devices. So I was, you know, looking through those and, you know, talking to Dave, you know, thinking about, you know, all these different devices. I realized, you know, let's say you play it out. You know, we build for, let's say, the next, you know, 2 to 3 years, what's coming out within the next 2 to 3 years. And that's kind of how we target things. We try to envision what things should be like at that time and what we could build. And, you know, but you play it out. So just the billions of devices in that time or the quarter trillion devices by 2025, realistically, okay, the sensors on these devices, they get pulled hundreds of times a second. So you think about the sheer volume of data that's coming off of this stuff. You couldn't centrally manage it. You couldn't put it in a central location. You have to do it decentralized. So you need a system in order to do decentralized data. I mean, we're doing our token offering essentially, you know, to become the currency of data. And that's what we see this emerging world becoming, a way to exchange data. You need a way to have trust in a trustless environment. You know, you think about it, you know, you take, and we've got thousands of use cases that we think are appropriate. But even, you know, I'll take one that might resonate with you know, a consumer layer, let's say at home. You know, you could do, you know, a health use case, right, at home. So you step on your IoT scale, right, at home. It's connected to the internet. That's connected to your Fitbit. It's connected to your fridge. It's connected to, you know, your Nest thermostat. It's connected to your health mirror that's giving you a readout of your vitals and information. You know, you'll take a pill that determines your blood glucose and your hormone levels. And you start thinking, you know, am I sharing this data with my doctor? Am I sharing this data with my insurance company to get a discount? Am I selling this data to a pharmaceutical company? Because I don't mind if they market to me, if they've got something that's going to help me. So that's like one of thousands of potential use cases, because the amount of data that's going to come off these devices, humans won't be able to sort through. You're going to need an artificial intelligence layer on top of it just to draw the insights between disparate data in different data sources. And you need this ability to be able to have smart contracts in order to pass data, have trust in a trustless environment. So all the things that blockchain is good at is really appropriate to IoT. We're using smart contracts as kind of a gatekeeper, right? So like we can decide, and you were wondering, you know, do we have to be on every device? Well, we can actually manage the data in between devices. And when I say the smart contract is a gatekeeper, you know, we can take a look at a device and say, did someone change the admin password? Is the latest security patch on that device? And then make a decision about the health of that network in order to say, am I going to pass data to that or not? You know, so just doing this securely, everyone gets that IoT is a huge market and that you know, companies are in a mad rush to get there. But the barriers have to do with this device management and security layer. Every one of those devices ends up being an endpoint for a hacker to get into. So it's got to be done wisely. It's got to be done thoughtfully. There's got to be a process and system in place to make it happen.
How do you think about the, you know, the current state of blockchain and distributed ledger technologies in terms of the, you know, the scalability? I think there's an enormous amount of promise, but right now we're in the early stages of the market. I mean, where do you see the opportunities and the challenges? And are there any, you know, certain approaches or ways to that you might be seeing to improve scalability, at least at this early stage, that are, you know, that have promise for you?
Absolutely. And so I think there's a lot of misconceptions on scalability. And I'll give you an example. When you buy something, right, with your Visa card, your credit card, you buy a shirt, it doesn't matter. The manufacturer, the person that, you know, the company that sold that, they don't see that money for a couple days. That's the way it works. Right? You get the item right away, but the back end processing that gets done takes a couple days. That's just the way it works. And so when you say, you know, there's, you know, you look at a transaction on blockchain taking 30 minutes, that's actually incredibly fast. And they often use these examples of transactions per second. And a lot of times the early protocols compared themselves to Visa because they were also digital currencies, the early on protocols, right? And so you know, you want to obviously get into the area of, you know, tens of thousands of transactions per second, okay? So we know that. Certain protocols by design are different than others. So Bitcoin is linkless, right? So let's say you have, you know, seven fields of data that's in a block or something. And, you know, just by the definition of a linked list, you can imagine it's single threaded, right? And there's inherent bottlenecks that are in that kind of technology. You could say the same thing about Ethereum, although, you know, there's Radon and there's Bitcoin Lightning and, you know, things that folks are working on. When you think about other protocols, okay, like IOTA. So that was, you know, goodness, almost a year ago, we did our integration with IOTA, and that uses a tangle or a DAG, a directed eclectic graph, which allows you to have, you can imagine hexagons or different shapes so that you have multiple vertices to be able to approve transactions. So two points end up approving, you know, another transaction, kind of making like a triangle, if you could imagine this shape, this kind of tangle shape. Well, what that does is, as you add more transactions, the faster it gets, because now you've got more vertices to be able to add transactions. All right. So we have to think fundamentally, almost mathematically, to determine the right kinds of protocols for the right kinds of use cases. In IoT, there's only a subset of protocols that we can use. And so we felt good about IOTA. Hashgraph, they've got a similar, you know, kind of structure. So these are the things that make the most amount of sense. Internally, you know, for, let's say, off-chain or on-prem, you know, within a company, you know, private protocols are totally fine. You know, you want the high volume, micro-transaction, micro-payment kind of protocols. So we've been using Hyperledger, you know, internally for that. What's great about Hyperledger is you can use Java, JavaScript, and our platform is based on Java. So it was just a natural, you know, way for us to do transactions, and smart contracts, you know, in Java. So yeah, that's kind of how we've determined those things. And you know, our online platform, it's on AWS, it's SaaS. We could spin up a region very easily. We've got load balancing and all that kind of thing. So we're designed to be highly scalable.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that you make about all those technologies. Are there any disconnects that you see or misperceptions in the market regarding, you know, particularly around IoT and blockchain technologies and the awareness of really how to apply them correctly?
I'll tell you the hardest thing with misconceptions is, you know, the fact that, you know, there's bad actors out there. And what's really happened is, I think about this. We had originally done our seed round through traditional venture capital. In the first year that we operated, we raised $3.5 million in a seed round that, came from Silicon Valley and New York. And, that's what got us started. And that's the thing that, startups need the most. You need some capital. You have to pay people and pay engineers in order to, get things done. And then through blockchain, you had a number of ICOs, and some of those folks, because it was a new method, there were bad actors that kind of took advantage of that and gave, bad impression of the space and technology, which is a shame because it's such a disruptive technology and has so much potential and opportunity. It should definitely flourish. And so what ends up happening is, you have all these companies and you'd see these spikes in ICOs and how much folks were raising. It's kind of interesting to watch how volatile, the market is with this, but it's very telling at the same time. So you get to understand there's so many startups that want to be innovative, that want to create new products and do things. And this was the method. The traditional method of raising capital was difficult. You had to pitch to a lot of VCs in order to raise the funds, in order to build the stuff that you wanted to take to market. And so this avenue came about, and it probably couldn't have come about unless there was other methods along the way. There was crowdfunder, there is, whether it's Indiegogo or Kickstarter or whatever, that kind of led up to this, certain crowdfunding stuff. And it's telling that so many companies needed the capital and it exposed this whole area. And then you had, unfortunately, some bad actors. So the misconception, I think there's a little spillover from, let's say, Silk Road and, that kind of thing when it comes to the digital currencies. But I think it's sorting itself out. And, I think that the legitimate companies that emerge and that could kind of shake this, off them, will be known, and then it'll be a little bit easier for them to move forward. And I'm excited about the space. It's got so much potential to disrupt so many industries. I'm excited.
Yes, I'd have to agree. And somebody made a comment that I thought was quite incisive, is that, this whole blockchain or crypto market or industry has, it really, you can see the extremes of the best aspects of human nature as well as the worst at the same time. And you can pick how you want to look at it. But of course, there's just an amazing amount of creative people. And you alluded to this, this change in the, in the funding atmosphere or the environment rather. And I think what's so interesting about your experience having worked at IBM and worked in Silicon Valley is, you've gotten a chance to see a lot of different sides of the industry and this transition of funding. As we look back a bit, what maybe some of the people or events that have that have really shaped your perspective? I mean, as you've had this this breadth of experience, are there any people? And I'd notice that you've been working with Tim Draper, and he's starting this he's got the Draper University as an example of somebody who's doing some really valuable work in helping to educate the community. What are some standouts in your experience?
Well, so I love Tim. Tim gave us our first $500,000. He kicked off our seed round, so owe him a debt of gratitude. And by observing Tim and his portfolio companies, I came to understand what disruption meant. And if you want to disrupt it or something, you got to feel comfortable with breaking things, right? And there's so many things that were ripe for disruption. You look at something like, the automotive industry, right? And so, driverless cars and, things that they're building now in electric cars and Tesla. And heck, that's one of, Tim's prominent, investments, in Elon Musk. That whole Silicon Valley way of thinking is what drives economies. And, you know, you got to innovate or fail. And it's a real important lesson, you know, to say, hey, we're going to wake up each morning and we're going to say to ourselves, if we were the competition, how would we disrupt our company? You know, and then go implement that. You know, it's been said that, you know, even in a company like, let's say, Kodak, you know, there were folks that brought digital imaging to the executives and said, hey, this is something, you know, that would be, you know, really great for us to pursue. And, you know, they said, well, that would cannibalize or kill our film business. Well, it did. It did. It's just they didn't do it and they had the opportunity. So, you know, there's countless examples that show, you know, you got to be disruptive. It's like, you know, there's a Blockbuster and there's the Netflix. And so it continues to happen. And I'm always surprised at the companies that don't learn that lesson. But that's a lesson, you know, by spending some time in Silicon Valley, it gets beaten into you, you know, innovate or die. Yeah. You go the way of the dinosaurs.
No, it's a really, powerful lesson to see how the growth of exponential technologies really can upend an industry in a very short amount of time. Some of the earlier guests we had on the podcast, like Tony Seba and Nick Gogarty, who are both authors and have focused a lot on disruptive and exponential technologies, have talked about really what's happening in the transportation industry, and we start to see that play out. But you know, as you've had experience in dealing with these disruptive technologies and being at the cutting edge, how would you compare and contrast, you know, the challenges that, you know, small companies or startups face versus, you know, work your experience for a large company like IBM? But, you know, we could really take any company, and certainly you have customers that are in the industrial space now that are adopting your wearables management technologies. I mean, how do you compare and contrast the thinking between sort of the small and large when it comes to embracing these disruptive technologies?
I'll tell you what, you get to a certain size and the processes, red tape and bureaucracy take over. And there's a couple companies that can do it. So, you know, Google seemed to have been able to, you know, figure it out, and Amazon, you know, a lot of respects. But a lot of companies in the past had difficulty making that, you know, transition. And you know, the what I had noticed, what I had observed in Silicon Valley was, you know, five people would start a company. The company would be started, you know, with the valuation of $5 million. You know, I'd say that technology is like fashion. So every year there's something new, even if it's only incrementally better than previous technology. That's the way it works. And then these five people determine how to solve problems in the marketplace using that new technology. And they're able to be agile and just move so much quicker and figure out that business case, you know, the technology side and the business side, in order to solve problems in the marketplace and create that engine of capital. And then, you know, companies, and this is what I'd observe, companies like IBM would look at the landscape and say, you know, here's complementary technology, a potential acqui-hire to get engineers. And the way it would work is it would take about 5 years, right? So there'd be a growth play each year that a startup would have. 1 year might be a geography play where they're selling their product in the U.S., but maybe they want to sell it in Asia or Europe. Next year, it might be a marketing play where they're just pointing people to the technology, right, to get more adoption. And so you do a growth play to get your $5 million to $100 million. And then in that year to five, you get an M&A broker that sends quarterly reports and a nice cover letter and, you know, works with that acquiring company, because, you know, not so many companies are IPOs. The vast majority are acquisitions. So, you know, your bigger companies, they can't innovate because of all that bureaucracy. It's easier for them to look across the landscape, and they always have a growth play. They can take that emerging technology and they can sell it to their 100,000 customers. So it's a formula that I witnessed that was repeated. Yet that's why you have serial entrepreneurs. They understand it and they just, execute that over and over every 5 years. And it's just, that's the way it works.
Yeah. Now, when you're looking back to the, the application of the Augmate platform for blockchain enabled wearables management and device management, are there any industries that you're particularly optimistic about where there could be real potential for transformative impact from adopting what you guys are putting together, which is really a next gen platform? Are there any industries or types of companies that stand out to you as areas of promise?
The ones that we see that seem to really make a difference, that we've got numbers on, for efficiency improvements and productivity improvements or accuracy improvements, supply chain are pretty significant. So the areas of logistics and distribution, those types of things. We field maintenance is also very relevant. Anywhere where you have, people with the expertise, this whole trend of boomers retiring and having, millennials that go out into the field, but yet call back to the office and, get kind of guided walkthroughs on how to fix certain things and repair things and that kind of thing in the field, that's certainly an area. Workflow and instruction we think are good. At the end of the day, a number of these systems, that these industries, it's only as good, this technology, as the content that's available. So, there's always this component of tying in a back-end system to be able to deliver the information to people. So that's the kind of piece. So you start thinking about, let's say a WMS, warehouse management system, or, a PLM type system or ERP type system that you connect to in order to pull out, the relevant and meaningful information to help workers.
Yeah, that's great. I think we will see a lot of these really core industrial processes can be so enhanced, and of course the demographic challenges of that aging workforce. It was a conversation that came up, that this idea that you're able to provide that enhanced information to somebody who might be just training to be a field technician somewhere, you can add 10 or 15 years of training on somebody with just technology to really backfill a lot of those shortcomings. So it is pretty amazing.
Yeah, you can make someone productive on day one. You could make them an expert, so to speak. Hire people that have actually lower skills and provide them on the job training, literally.
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful. So, as you look out over the next decade, I mean, what is your vision of how ultimately the market for industrial wearables will evolve, and adjacent to that, or I guess in conjunction with that, how we see the blockchain space evolve as well? I would love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I actually started with the vision of unlimited storage. When I started to see this trend of processors go down in cost and storage go down in cost, I really started thinking, what would you capture if you had no limitations, and when it came to storage, and what would you process if you had no limitations on process? And really, came to the determination, you capture everything you could. And so that really then started to beg the question about our reliance on artificial intelligence. Because, the reason why it's important is because you can't make changes on things that you don't measure. And you need data to make good decisions, right? We don't make emotional decisions. We don't make, knee-jerk decisions. We make decisions based on information. And there's going to be a lot of information. So I think artificial intelligence that rides on top of this layer of IoT is critical. It's going to assist in the applications and services on this, fourth generation of the internet, this layer. 5G, will certainly be, a part of that. And you know, just blockchain that communicates across the devices. Because here's how things kind of work, right? In anything in life or in work, you know, you take an action, you communicate the action, and then that action is somehow processed, right? So last generation of the internet, we figured out the communication piece. You know, let's say you take an action and you communicate it. You know, they got TCP/IP. You get your text messages all the time. The communication layer, that's fine. What we needed was a universal way to really take transactions and process them universally across different systems, disparate systems. That's what blockchain does. That's what smart contracts do. So this integration of blockchain and the fourth generation of the internet, it's interwoven. This is the connection point. And that's why I said in the beginning of the call, there's converging technologies that have to take place. That's when the light bulb moment kind of happens. Like, oh, we needed this. This is what was missing. Like, you know, okay, now we've got all the pieces. Now I see what the picture looks like. So it's that piece that then you're able to then kind of take things to the next level. And that's what I'm excited about. I love working on emerging technologies, and at my level, I put out the vision, and then fortunately we hire good engineers to build it. But I learned early on, there's hardly a problem that you could position to an engineer that they can't figure out, you know, given the time and given, you know, the technology. So it's exciting.
Yeah, this whole concept of convergence around these multiple technologies is really compelling, and you highlighted the importance of AI that gets layered on top of that unlimited storage and cloud computing, and then you have the cheap processing that will enable the visual rendering of data, and then of course blockchain, which creates that amazing trust layer, and it's all happening together. It really is an amazing time to be alive. So share your optimism around that. Pete, this has just been a fantastic conversation. We've hit so many different topics. One of the questions I always like to ask of anybody that I talk to is for a recommendation whether it's a book or a resource that, you know, something that you would share with somebody who's looking to get a little bit deeper either into the technologies or just something that you would share with a friend. Is there anything that comes to mind?
Sure. You know what? I still like Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And
that's a great book. Yeah,
it really is. And, you know, I catch myself because, you know, we've got biases and we've got, you know, kind of quick thinking. And I've learned to, sometimes even wait a day. It seems like, you know, I'm an impatient guy, but I'll tell you what, I've made better decisions by holding off and thinking about my biases and thinking about, oftentimes those knee-jerk, instant kind of ways of thinking about something are so flawed. And what he gets into is the way the brain works, and oftentimes thinking that you see the whole picture. And I've learned to ask questions, and I've learned to not send an email until I've, you know, maybe slept on it. And I've learned a lot of different things that, you know, how quick thinking is often flawed. But, you know, he even goes into how, deeper or slower thinking, you know, could be flawed as well, and just how to get past that. So I absolutely love that book. There's another one out there that's out by Mark Manson. It's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a, and then the it's a F-U-C-K.
Yeah.
Word. And that's an interesting one, and that's really about, you know, just being real. It's just being, you know, it's saying, you know, we can't just focus on the positive. Well, that would be nice, and that, you know, might make you feel better temporarily, but let's just take an honest approach at things. And, you know, let's, you know, especially in this age, you know, with Twitter and Instagram and all sorts of, you know, different ways that we communicate quickly, let's get rid of ego. And let's just have honest and frank discussions about things, we move so much quicker, and we can actually be happier if we're just, you know, honest this way. So getting rid of ego and just having good conversations, and that's where real relationships happen. You know, real relationships in business and real relationships in our personal life. So I would recommend those two. There's so many, but you know, at top of mind, those are two.
Those are great recommendations, Pete, and I think our listeners will certainly appreciate them as well. So, again, that was a terrific conversation. We really hit a lot of cool topics, and I was thrilled to get some more of a chance to hear your insights. And again, we'll be including the links to the books in the show notes. But again, I just want to thank you for taking the time, Pete, to share your thinking. As always, it's a tremendously fascinating conversation, and we'll hope we'll do it again soon.
Awesome, Ed. Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime.
All right, thanks. This is Ed McGuire, Insights Partner from Momenta, with another Edge podcast. Thank you for listening to the Momenta Intelligent Edge podcast. We rely on feedback, comments, and input from our listeners. So please interact with us by going to our LinkedIn page, our Twitter accounts, or email us at edge@momenta.partners with any suggestions, guest ideas, or commentary. We really value your input and appreciate your listening. Thanks a lot. This is Ed McGuire, Insights Partner with Momenta Partners.